I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday Culture Connections. Charleston and Pittsburgh are two cities that will forever be connected in our collective memory after the heinous acts of violence that claimed the lives of 20 people in their respective houses of worship. Dr. Beverly E. Mitchell, a professor of historical theology at the Wesley Theological Seminary, joins me and Dr. Sherry Parks for an examination of the links between anti-Semitism and anti-Black racism in the United States. We'll look at how the racialization of certain groups feeds narratives of hate, and we'll explore the links between religiosity and racism and the role of interfaith engagement in combating intolerance. Plus, the future of local arts criticism with the departure of two veteran critics from the Baltimore Sun. First, the news. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us today for Midday. Before we begin our program, an update to a story that we brought you last week. Last Thursday, I talked about the future of the Democratic Party in Maryland with the two women who were running to be the Maryland State Party chair, Kathleen Matthews, who is the current chair, and her friend and fellow activist, Maya Rockymore Cummings. The election was held on Saturday in Lanham at a meeting of the Democratic State Central Committee of Maryland. Maya Rockymore Cummings emerged the winner. She was elected to a 4-year term as the state chair. Dr. Cummings is a policy consultant and a former Capitol Hill staffer. She is married to Congressman Elijah Cummings. State Senator-elect Corey McCray of Baltimore City was elected first vice chair of the Maryland Democratic Party. We hope to speak with Dirk Hare. He's the chair of the Maryland Republican Party soon. We'll get his take on the status of the Maryland GOP following Republican Governor Larry Hogan's historic reelection last month. Today, it's our monthly installment of the series Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. She is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art and a scholar who studies popular culture. Good to see you, Sherry.
Good to see you.
And we are joined today by Dr. Beverly E. Mitchell. She's a professor of historical theology at the Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Dr. Mitchell will be speaking as part of the Mannequin Clark Lecture Series of the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies next week on Wednesday night. She studies the link between racism and racial anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. Dr. Mitchell, it's great to meet you.
It's a pleasure to meet you as well.
And listeners, if you'd like to be part of our conversation about intolerance, anti-Semitism, racism, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at Midday WYPR, and you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. So, Dr. Mitchell, let me begin by asking you to give us a sort of an overview, a sketch of the concentration of your scholarly pursuits.
Well, I am very much committed to the concept of human dignity. That's become an important theme in the work I do, whether it's historical or whether it has to do with theology, that I am committed to attention being raised with regard to those who are in situations of oppression. And I have really grappled with the question of what it means to be human and how is dignity connected to that. And I've opted to look at communities of oppression in order to, and particularly in terms of slavery and the Holocaust, in order to determine what makes us human when we are in dehumanizing situations.
And human dignity, you wrote a book called Plantations and Death Camps, Religion, Ideology, and Human Dignity. Mm-hmm. Is human dignity dependent on a notion of God, a notion of is dignity, you know, imputed by a higher power, or is it possible to be to become dignified, to have dignity absent any faith connection?
I believe that it is possible. I would affirm that, and know of communities who are not particularly religious, but who would affirm the notion of human dignity, that we all have it. For me, as a Christian, I've grounded that in a connection with the idea that humans are created in the image of God, and that therefore it's given to us, it's imputed to us, it's a gift, and I think grounding it in something that is or someone that's transcendent makes it more difficult to challenge the dignity of others because of race or national origin or whatever the divisions that we use. It is much easier to assume that we can confer dignity on others. And I'm very much in opposition to the notion that any human being confers dignity on another. It's something mm-hmm. that they've been given.
And Sherry, what do you think? How's that strike you?
Well, I think that what it means to be human is a central question not only of theology but also of the humanities. And the idea, and I mean, centuries of what does this mean? And the idea that even in the humanities, that there is something inside of us that carries, I'll use the word spirit, although not all the writers will use that, mm-hmm. that carries something that makes us self-consciously aware of ourselves and others and operating in a cultural, social space isn't really important. And that's where these two, I think, theories and ideologies come together in a really wonderful way.
And you write a lot about, Dr. Mitchell, about the racialization of groups and how that is a stepping stone to dehumanizing, to de-dignifying, that leads directly to intolerance and racism, anti-Semitism, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. And in reflecting on that in terms of my own existential reality as an African American, but also in terms of my sympathies toward those groups who experience a denial of their personhood or a questioning of their right to exist, I wanted to get at the crux of what is behind these ways of collectivity in which we are very quick to label, to isolate, create hierarchies in which some people are in and some people are out. And, as I've reflected on that in terms of the context here in the United States, in terms of the importing of slaves from Africa and what may have been an economic endeavor, the need to justify it by ideas about inferiority. Is something, that I've thought a lot about and noted that in the 19th century, where there is this, a deep interest in classifying and kind of using pseudo-scientific ideas about that help to ensure a stratification of different groups really takes hold in the 19th century and I think is very much a part of the racialization of Jews in Germany, but it fed right into the segregation which occurred in the United States after the end of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. There's an interesting, at least to me, thread here. It may not seem immediately obvious, the link that you just made between theology and science, but many of the ideas that not only what we think of the hard sciences and the social sciences actually emanate from religious texts. We may not ever overcome the idea of darkness being bad. And you certainly see that in the scriptures. And then you see it in alchemy, where you're turning something dark into something shiny gold. And then you can, that becomes chemistry and other sciences. And I'm not saying that it works the other way around. I am saying that people took these ideas that were very commonly known and then extrapolated them in some ways that were pretty damaging.
Yes, that really is true. That, and there have been many times in which religion or sacred texts have been used to as handmaidens in projects of domination of other groups, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's fascinating, Sherry. And Dr. Mitchell, in your book, you write about a German professor of medicine, Johann Friedrich Blumenbach, who coined the term Caucasian.
Yes.
And this was a continuation of a post-Enlightenment Renaissance trend to sort of elevate Europeans and devalue those peoples of color.
Exactly.
And when was Blumenbach, was he a 19th century phenomenon?
In the 19th century figure, yes.
Because the whole notion of race in popular culture, which you've, of course, written a lot about, Sherry, continues to evolve. But the germ of it is something that was established a long time ago. We have not shaken those somewhat very, very much antiquated notions of what race even means.
Right. I mean, and while this is not exactly what we're talking about, in the early text, they talk about the shining darkness, but that has been pulled away, and darkness means bad and is equated with evil constantly in American culture.
Yes.
And so, I mean, you can watch this in the historical literature that gets labeled onto people who were seen as black. They were darker than Europeans, the wholesale.
Mm-hmm.
And then that begun. And you can also, and we talked about this a couple of months ago, that idea of darkness and blackness even gets labeled onto white immigrant groups, Italians and Irish.
Yes.
And so, you can join the club of darkness and then be treated in a certain way.
Yeah. And darkness shows up in chapter 1, verse 1 of the Bible. I mean, Genesis, darkness covered the earth, and the earth was without form and void. And there was light. That's the first thing that God creates,
Absolutely.
And light as the opposite thing of darkness. Mm-hmm. So this is really rooted in the very basic stories of human culture.
Yes.
We've heard from Bob, who says, I used to work at Social Security headquarters in Woodlawn. He gets to us via Facebook, I guess. Every April, the commissioner hosted a Holocaust memorial program. The audience is mostly employees, and it was a mix of whites and blacks. One year, Gwendolyn King, who was the commissioner from 89 to 92, she was an African-American, said, to those of you in this audience who are black and might think this Jewish Holocaust thing doesn't apply to you, listen to me. You show me somebody who doesn't like Jews, well, they don't like you either.
Yes.
So there is this lineage between anti-blackness and anti-Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a kind of a chicken and the egg thing? I mean, the anti-Judaism goes way back, to the earliest days of Christianity.
Sure.
And the earliest days of the Middle Ages, and persecutions of Jews as the Christ killers is nothing new. It's interesting to me, as I read about your work, it seems to me that the Jews were then accused of a specific thing, deicide.
Yes.
So what were Africans accused of? I mean, what was their crime that made them susceptible to being enslaved, I wonder?
Well, historically, there have been issues around color. And so it's not as though in the 16th, 17th century, all of a sudden, we have an issue about color. It is something that's long-standing. And I know a colleague of mine, J. Cameron Carter, who has written about race and ties it to the New Testament and shapes and connects it with with anti-Semitism. I am a little more cautious about figuring out the link so much. Knowing that it's there, but figuring out the origin of the links is something that I still reflect on.
It's Midday Culture Connections. Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art is here, as always. And our guest is Dr. Beverly E. Mitchell. She's a professor of historical theology at the Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. We'll have more with Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Parks when we come back after a quick break. Our number here on Midday to be part of our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter at Tom Hall, WYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. We'll be right back. Stick around. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, the funeral of President George H.W. Bush begins at 11 o'clock. NPR will have live coverage, and following that event, we'll have a look back at the life and legacy of President Bush with Dr. Nathan Conley. He's an associate professor of history at Johns Hopkins University. Mr. Bush has been lying in state in the rotunda of the Capitol since last night. He was, of course, our nation's 41st president. He died Friday night at the age of 94. We'll remember President Bush here on Midday tomorrow. Coming up a little later today here on Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks, a look at the state of arts criticism here in Baltimore with the departure of two of the Baltimore Sun's cultural critics, Tim Smith and Wesley Case. They left the paper before Thanksgiving. But first, we return to our guest, the historical theologian, Dr. Beverly E. Mitchell. We're talking about the subject on which she'll be speaking here in Baltimore a week from tomorrow, the relationship between anti-Black racism and anti-Semitism. You are welcome to be part of our conversation today. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Sherry, just as our notions of science and race have grown out of theology and grown out of faith traditions, our whole notion of what it means to suffer, what it means to be persecuted, comes from the same font.
Well, and I mean, and at first I need to say I'm extremely proud of being the child of those who survived. Mm-hmm. And so surviving, and I've long admired our ability to be human under horrific circumstances, which I think is also a theme of your work. This is a Judeo-Christian analysis, as one would think would come from a reverend. And I think that leaves the question of the role between suffering and perceptions of virtue that come. If we look at it from through the oppressed, because we tend to equate those two. Sometimes some people don't deserve it. And I was wondering about how you would describe that relationship between suffering and perceptions of virtue.
It's a problematic, I think, in some instances. The reality is that if you're fighting against a social order that's unjust, you are going to suffer. If you are under the thumb of a social order that's unjust, you will suffer. But I'm always a little hesitant about applying the notion of suffering as though the oppressed are wearing a cloak, and that somehow their suffering can be redemptive in the meantime. Martin Luther King talked a lot about redemptive suffering. And women, whether they're feminists or womanists from the African American religious tradition, have taught us not to buy in so much to this notion of suffering. Because it makes it sacred in a way that can paralyze the impulse to struggle against, to fight. And I do believe in the possibility that good can come out of a situation that causes suffering. But to equate that in some way in the heads of some people, that this is suffering like Christ, and you're picking up your cross and carrying it. I think in the cause of justice, that is what we may well have to do. But sometimes in our communities, they don't nuance that, and they assume everything you're going through that makes you suffer is you're carrying the cross. And so it makes us a little nervous to talk about that. But the reality is, in fact, that if you go against the powers that be, you will, in fact, suffer.
But that's fascinating. So there should be a distinction between kinds of suffering, because when we talk about suffering and as you put it, the perceptions of virtue, it seems that suffering is something that everybody can identify. We know when you're suffering, but virtue, boy, that's a slippery thing, right? Because 10 different people could describe virtuous behavior or describe virtue in different ways.
Well, and actually, you mentioned that I study popular culture, and sometimes that is axiomatic. I have shown my students the first 10 minutes of the Disney Cinderella. And is she virtuous? Everybody says she's virtuous. Why? Because she suffered.
Mm.
Right? Mm, direct lineage between the suffering and
because that's all she does.
The presence of virtue, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because persecution is a central tenet of the Jewish tradition. Redemptive, salvific suffering is a central tenet of Christianity. I'm less familiar with what the tenets of Islam are, but certainly there is an element of suffering in that faith tradition, the three Abrahamic religions. So it's interesting to place them in a contextual way is complicated, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But it's important to make those distinctions. It's important to interrogate the notion of placing virtue on people simply because they're suffering. It becomes their lot. It becomes the means by which they are thought of almost as having value, the fact that they're suffering. And that's problematic.
It's Midday Culture Connections. Dr. Beverly Mitchell joins Dr. Sherry Parks and me. I'm Tom Hall. We are glad you're with us. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page, where we are streaming our conversation live from Studio A. Let's go to the phones to Pat in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Parks.
Hi, yes. In listening, I'm wondering if you all have put together or recognized that it seems to me that a community, the people that hold the values of the community, let's say they put together a society, and what happens is that they create an enemy out of someone in order to have their people buy into that they must do harm to these people in order to keep their community together. And a lot of times they choose religion as the way to do it, because if you're fighting for God, you're fighting for the ultimate person in your life, you know, the Creator. And I'm wondering how that fits into how we put together, for instance, the South. They're very Christian oriented, and yet there's so much hatred involved. And you know, I wonder how that they fit together. They don't fit together in my mind, but I'm wondering how that fits together.
Dr. Mitchell,
that is an issue that you raise that I think is very important to take note of, the way in which a religious tradition is used to sanctify behavior that's antithetical to the principles of the faith. And we did see that in the South and other places as well, in which you even had churchmen, clergy, who were part of the Klan or the White Citizens Council in the South, and seen as moral people, and yet they held and were engaged in actions that were antithetical to the gospel of Christ. And so it certainly does operate. Religion is part of culture, language, one's belief system, how one organizes one's life. And all of that can be a part of the building blocks for an ideology that privileges some groups over another. And we see that operating even with regard to anti-Muslim sentiment. We have created a racial group out of a diverse religious tradition and invested in an ideology that brings harm to other people. And so religion can be, often is, a tool.
Yeah, well, thanks for that call, Pat. And here, you know, it seems to me that the racialization of Muslims, of Islam, which is, you know, adhered to by more than a billion people from countries all over the world, there's a parallel to that to the racialization of Jews, who also came from all over the world, and different backgrounds, different languages, different traditions, different cultures. But all of a sudden, they're all Jews, you know, and now we have Muslims. And when it comes to the immigration policy of the current American administration, to be sure, this raises all sorts of questions about how we are defining groups, and that's this notion again of the other.
Right, and it's not a great word, but otherization is the process, and oversimplification of the people you want to make a group is the first step of erasing their humanity.
Yes.
The word that we started talking about. And, you know, this starts in the Crusade. Well, it doesn't start, but, you know, really prominently during the Crusades, where, I mean, this was at least in part about looting, but it was a quote religious war. I want to circle back though to the American South, because we have to separate out gender a bit in order to understand how religiosity, because the people who were clergy and in the Klan would say that what they were targeting was black male sexuality. There was a lot of talk about
as a threat,
as a threat, and the debasement, and they were protecting Cinderella, that virtuous white woman, from the debased black male sexuality, who was seen as, I mean, the first time I saw Imitation of Life, there's a quote rape scene, and I watched it several times, which was torture, because I was looking for the rape scene. There's no rape scene. There's, you know, a black man trying to proclaim his love for a white woman, but it was perceived as a rape scene. Mm-hmm. And so that assumption that he is evil because he is dark and masculine is an archetype that pervades Western culture since forever.
Yeah, goes way back before the Civil War,
right,
that's for sure.
Right. Yeah. But it comes to the present day.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You had those kind of predatory notions of Jews in mm-hmm. Germany. Mm-hmm. You certainly, we hear that rhetoric with
that's
regard to immigrants.
Now. Yeah.
Yes.
When it comes to national levels of hate crimes in the United States, 2014 was something of a nadir. It was the lowest level since national reporting began in 1992, and they have been steadily, the incidence of hate crimes against blacks, against Jews, against Muslims, have been steadily climbing since, particularly in the last 2 years, between 2016 and 2017, for which that's the last year that data is available. So, Dr. Mitchell, in terms of an interfaith response. There's a piece in the Washington Post a few days ago, co-signed by Wajahat Ali, who's a very funny guy and a columnist, television host, Reverend Dr. William Barber, Dr. Simone Campbell, and Stosh Kotler. So a Catholic theologian, a Baptist theologian, a Jewish theologian, and a Muslim figure, intellectual, about the faithful response to the immigration policy of the current administration. So what's your advice, your take on how an interfaith response can be formulated to what's going on?
Well, it's I believe is absolutely critical that religious communities stand up and speak against, in as a prophetic witness, that the ways in which we demonize others and deny their dignity, deface them, is inconsistent with what it means to value human life, and they must not be silent. There have been too many occasions in which religious communities have been silent in the face of these things. This is not a moment to do that, and in engaging each other in a solidarity, a recognition that we are all in this together. It may be your community today, but tomorrow it will be someone else, that we have to stand together despite our differences in terms of our religious beliefs. We stand as a witness about ethical response to what happens to human beings, and so I think it's important to bear witness, but also to gather together to work within our own communities to reinforce the notion that we are tied together as human beings.
They make the point in this piece in the Washington Post, Jesus says that if we don't welcome the stranger, we will be condemned eternally. Rejecting the stranger is rejecting God. Islam teaches that those who accept refugees are true believers, and welcoming the stranger is a core principle of Judaism because we were once strangers. So, Sherry Parks, do you see a different, as a person who's really good at measuring the zeitgeist, is there a different tenor to the consideration and the response to anti-immigrant reaction in the United States now, for example, as opposed to the Catholic Church's reaction to Nazism or the clergy's reaction to slavery in the 19th century? I mean, have things evolved? Are religious communities doing what should be done and what could be done?
No, and I think this gets back to some of the things that we've been talking about, that the perception of the outsider has now been codified, that they're a threat, and we are in, and I don't use this word lightly, we are now the oppressor. The United States is now the oppressor to people who are suffering, but their suffering has been cut out of the narrative. They're at the border, but their narrative before they get here and why they're here, as asylees, many of them, has been cut out. And so what those clergy were trying to do is to go against what is now the dominant narrative. And that is, from my perspective, to be highly commended. But they're swimming upstream, I'm afraid, because we have acquiesced to this dominant narrative of the dangerous outsider.
And Dr. Mitchell, we just have a couple minutes left here, but this intersection of faith and politics is certainly nothing new in American politics. And there are many people on the evangelical Christian in the evangelical Christian movement who are quite supportive of the president, meaning they support not only his nominees to the Supreme Court, but also his immigration policy and policies having to do with trade and all a wide range of things. And they're basing that support theologically and ideologically. How do you think what should the response of the rest of the Christian church be, the rest of Judaism, the rest of Islam be to that?
The response is to challenge this conflation of political conservatism and religious conservatism. And I do want to point out that within the evangelical community, it's broader than it has been. And there are elements of the evangelical community who recognize this conflation as problematic. But engaging each other, despite the fact that you strongly disagree, is one way to keep the conversation going. And I think recognizing that people are human, you know, even if you really disagree with some of their policies, is something we desperately need in our
time. Let's see if we can sneak in one more phone call. Farouk is on the line. Welcome to Midday, Farouk. Thanks for your call.
All right. Thanks very much, Tom. I always call to you, and you brought two very great ladies, and I'm listening to you all the time. My comment is that if you are Christian, if you are Jews, if you are Muslim, this is between you and your God. Do not create a hatred between the human being. I'm in this country for 35 years. We have a big society open for everybody. President Obama came to our mosque, Islamic Society of Baltimore, last year. So encourage the people, you know, stand up for Jews, for Christians, for Muslims. You all created for God. The people around us create hatred between us for their own, I don't know, political reason or whatever it is. But I love you, Tom. I love the sister because your religion is with your God. What you do is between you and your God. But we are friends, we are citizens, we are brothers and sisters. That's what I can say.
Well, Farouk, we appreciate your listening, appreciate your kind words. And Dr. Mitchell, Dr. Parks, we both as well appreciate your being here this afternoon. And Sherry, you're going to stick around. We're going to talk a little bit more about another subject. So thanks so much. Appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
Dr. Beverly E. Mitchell is professor of historical theology at the Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. A week from tomorrow, Wednesday night the 12th, Dr. Mitchell will be speaking as part of the Manikin Clark Lecture Series at the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. She'll speak at Emmanuel Episcopal Church in Baltimore at 7 o'clock. And we've got details on our website, wypr.org/midday. Quick break, and when we return, we'll examine the future of arts criticism in the local press with Dr. Sherry Parks as Midday Culture Connections continues. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. This is music of Leonard Bernstein. That's the Simple Song from his iconic Mass. You may have read an article about a recent performance by students at the Peabody Conservatory and performers from several churches and other schools of this large and complicated work. It included more than 500 people from the local area. So you might have read that article that happened before the concert took place, but you probably didn't read a review of that performance in the Sun. As a matter of fact, I'm certain that you didn't read a review of that performance in the Sun because the critic wanted to write one, but his editors didn't think it was a good idea. So now we're going to continue our conversation here on Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks, talking about the future of arts criticism. The two remaining full-time critics at the Baltimore Sun left the paper last month. Tim Smith came to the Sun as the classical music critic in 2000. By the time he retired, he was covering not only classical music, but theater, museum shows, and restaurants as well. Wesley Case has covered the pop music scene and nightlife since 2008. He's now headed to Philadelphia to work on a sports news startup. So in addition to her position as vice president at MICA, Sherry Parks is also the chair of the board of the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance, an organization of visual, musical, literary, and dance artists that includes organizations large and small, as well as individual artists. So, Sherry, what's been the reaction to the news that the two full-time critics at The Sun are no longer there?
Well, it's been a reaction of great concern. Often, criticism does two things for the arts community in addition to what it does for the audience. One, it gives, especially if they're doing a preview, because they may get to see a performance or a show before the public, they're bringing people into that performance or exhibit. but also the idea of a, and this gets to your point of a full-time beat, that someone who is knowledgeable and someone who is thoughtful about the art form, writing about it, helps the artist, and an artist pointed this out, that they need to hear that kind of response, but also it helps the audience be more thoughtful about what is going on.
Listeners, if you have reaction, comment, questions about the arts coverage in The Sun, our number here at midday, 410-662-8780. You can also talk about the arts coverage anywhere else, including here on this program, Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet, and you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Here is a statement from The Sun. This comes from Renee Muchnick on behalf of Trif Alatsis, who is the publisher and managing editor. She wrote to me last week when I gave her a call about this. Tim Smith is a valued and talented reporter and critic. His recent retirement does not impact our commitment to covering Baltimore's vibrant arts and entertainment scene. As we recruit to fill positions, we are confident that with more journalists than any other media organization in Baltimore, we are able to continue to cover the arts in a way that best serves our readers. And I wrote back to her and asked if that included reviewing concerts rather than doing or reviewing events rather than doing pre-articles before they happen. And she wrote back and said, yes, we will still do reviews. We will review our hiring options based on the candidates. So please spread the word that we're looking for skilled journalists. So this seems to indicate that The Sun is at least considering hiring people to replace Tim and Wes Case. But I know Tim, with whom I spoke last week, is a little skeptical of that outcome.
Well, there's actually been literature on the difference between a journalist and a critic. And there is a big difference. We should point out that this is part of a larger trend of newspapers, for cost-saving reasons, asking reporters to cover. I mean, when you pointed out the different things that Tim Smith had been covering, and then you get to restaurants. But the general trend is to ask generalists to cover more things. And that means that there is a lack of, not always, but often, there becomes a lack of depth because someone is discovering opera or a certain line of visual art, and a critic has years of thinking about that and has a context. And there really is a difference between that.
When I had my conversation with Tim last week, he's been a member of the Music Critics Association. I forget exactly what the name of it is, but it's a you know, association of people who write music criticisms. And his guess is that there are probably only 10 full-time classical music critics left in the country. And there used to be that every major metropolitan newspaper had one. And he makes the point that certainly the message he got when he was serving as the classical music critic was that he had to expand his portfolio because those were not the pieces that were getting clicks. And it's all about clicks when it comes to newspapers. So the papers are making decisions based on financial realities. And if they don't make decisions that are, you know, prudent financial decisions, we're not going to have any paper at all. So, you know, he was saying, for example, that restaurants seem to be of much more interest to people than classical music or even theater or some of the other arts events that are going on around town.
Well, and there's an irony inherent in that the people who are reading newspapers tend to be older, they tend to be more white, they're more likely to be male, which, except for the gender part, is exactly the audience for classical music. But to measure by clicks is a pretty rough measure of someone reading an article to its end.
Yeah, interesting, because Tim mentioned something that I hadn't thought of, which is that there's really no way for the paper to track those people who are reading the hard copy of the paper.
Right.
Yeah, and when they're reading that, you don't know which articles they're reading and which ones they're skimming over. But when it comes to the internet and people are accessing it through their app or through their computer, you know exactly what they're looking at. You know exactly how many people are looking at it and how long they're spending. I mean, you can track that kind of information, and that's what they're producing their paper based on two premises. One, that the journalism is going to be good and it's going to be credible. And second is that they're going to be writing about things that people are interested in.
Well, I mean, there's a research element in there. I mean, it wasn't that nobody knew who was reading, but you had to go to a third party to ask people, you know, do you buy the paper? Do you read the paper? How many minutes do you read the paper? And that was pretty well known, but it was generalized. There's also an assumption that a click equals reading, which it often doesn't. And even in the research, people call it eyes, that you assume that there are a lot. How many times do you click on something and immediately click away, but it's still counted as a click? So we still don't know what people are doing.
By the way, full disclosure, Sherry is the president of the board of the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance. That's a position I once held when I was a full-time member of the cultural arts community as the music director of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. And Tim Smith covered the Baltimore Choral Arts Society as part of his beat. Now, there is, you know, and people have talked about this, not just in terms of arts journalism, but journalism in general, the shrinking of local newsrooms. Affects an awful lot of things. The shrinking of the Baltimore Sun newsroom affects this program because we rely so heavily on the, you know, the on-the-ground reporting that the print reporters in this market can do, from the Capital Gazette, from the Washington Post, from the Baltimore Sun. It's very important, certainly for me, in my perch here, to find out what's going on through the people who are out there on the street. I'm not out there in the street. I'm sitting here in the studio with you and a lot of great guests, but to really have an understanding of what's cooking, I need to rely on those reporters. For example, the Baltimore Symphony right now is going through a very difficult time. They've not had a contract with their musicians since the 9th of September. There's a brief extension to the current contract, which ends at the beginning of next month. And it's very much up in the air where that will go. So far, we've had some dueling letters to the editor in the newspaper, in the Baltimore Sun, people from the Players Committee, people from the Board of Directors talking about two very different directions for the orchestra to go. Tim Smith was the person, the one person in the Baltimore market of all of the media outlets here who really understands the history, the context of what's going on with the symphony now, because he was around 18 years prior and he saw how things have evolved since the year 2000. That kind of historical context, that kind of institutional memory is very important. So right now I can't point to a person here in this market who knows what's going on, the sort of the intricacies of what's going on with the largest arts organization in the state of Maryland.
And that's an interesting example, because what you're left with is what you described, which is the either or, when the nuance is usually in the middle, but there's nobody in the middle anymore.
And that's unfortunately all the time we have, because we are stuck in the middle of a time crunch here, and so we got to go. But Sherry, it's always good to see you, ma'am, and we'll see you next time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Sherry Parks, she's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. And she is the host of Beyond the Ballot. It's a segment you can hear on the second and fourth Thursday of every month during All Things Considered here on WYPR. And she joins us here on Midday on the first Tuesday of the month for Midday Culture Connections. That is it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, reflections on the life and legacy of President George H.W. Bush, who died last Friday at the age of 94. NPR will have live coverage of the president's funeral at the Washington National Cathedral tomorrow. That begins at 11 o'clock here on WYPR. And when that event concludes, we'll talk about the 41st president's place in history with Dr. Nathan Connolly of Johns Hopkins University. We'll take your calls and your comments about Mr. Bush's life and work. That's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. They also provide catering and a party room for your holiday events. You can find out more at joesquared.com. Here and Now is coming up after a break for news. That comes up at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Thanks very much on behalf of the entire Midday team. Have a great day.